Okay, I'd like to open the December 15, 2010 meeting of the House Interim Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Welcome to everyone here present today, as well as our television audience. Our first topic of discussion is weatherization and energy training programs, and we have Jim Dawson, who's the program director from the Northwest Research and Training Center, with us today. Jim, welcome.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you for inviting me to discuss our program. I've got about 2 hours worth of material that we'll cram into about 15 or 20 minutes, and I'll be happy to answer any questions as we go along, or we can wait till the end, whichever works best for you.
Okay. Jim, if you would please just begin by introducing yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. I am Jim Dawson. I am the program manager for the Oregon Energy Coordinators Association. I'm also the director of the Northwest Research and Training Center for Energy and Weatherization.
Thank you.
So my information is up there. I think you all have got my handouts, which is basically just a printout of this PowerPoint that we're running through. Did everybody get a copy of it?
Yes.
Okay, great.
So we're good to go.
Moving right along, what I wanted to do is cover a little bit of the background of our organization and some of our capabilities, and discuss some of our ongoing projects, in particular our weatherization and training center and programs project. And then take any questions at the end, or like I said, if you've got any questions as I'm going through to help clarify anything that I say, because I tend to ramble on sometimes, as I'm doing right now. So what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about the organization. We don't go as far back as the Oregon Trail, but we've been around for 30 years. This is our 30th anniversary this year. We're all very proud of that. We were founded in 1980 primarily to promote the exchange of information between all the energy and weatherization program sub-grantees that were receiving money from the United States Department of Energy to fund energy efficiency and weatherization programs. The membership has grown to include all the community action agencies, the tribal governments, state administrative staff, electric and gas utilities, both the investor-owned and some public utilities, and other nonprofits that are working in other energy and weatherization programs, including the Energy Trust of Oregon. We work closely with Oregon Housing Community Services. They are the grantee for the U.S. Department of Energy Weatherization Assistance Program, and we work with them to help coordinate efforts among all our members. We also own and operate the Northwest Research and Training Center for Energy and Weatherization. We just call it the RTC. So our functions primarily, as I mentioned, is to coordinate the delivery of the programs with OHCS. We host quarterly membership meetings where we can conduct peer exchange meetings and discuss issues arising with the federal grant. We exchange technical information and work with other people. In many cases, the only time we can all get together in one place is at these quarterly meetings. We conduct peer exchange visits and mentorships as the newer agencies coming on board or their employees. We can help match them up with somebody who's been around for a while to help show them the ropes. The members of the organization, and we've got around 100 members representing roughly 60 agencies. They sit on various energy-related panels around the Northwest. We also provide input into developing the state energy and weatherization technical documents, so we'll talk a little bit about those. We also provide training and have been for about 30 years, the last 8 years, in a formal program that is endorsed by OHCS. And they also help us with the certification for those training programs. I want to talk in particular about the last three items on there, the technical documents, the training, and the certification. So that's our focus today. So let's talk about technical document maintenance here. The three primary documents that we work off of are the site-built housing and mobile home weatherization specifications for the State of Oregon Weatherization Assistance Program, which is a mouthful, so we usually just shorten that to the weatherization tech specs or just the tech specs. We have the Oregon Weatherization Field Guide and the Oregon Mechanical Systems Field Guide, and those documents together provide guidance and direction for people who are doing energy efficiency and weatherization work throughout the state for all the weatherization assistance programs. The documents themselves are peer-reviewed. We take input from anybody who uses them as to whether the documents themselves are working properly or if there's new industry standards that have come out. We make sure those are incorporated. We make sure that all our field guides are reflecting good practices. We spend an awful lot of time discussing issues not only within the state and around the region, but also throughout the country. We have an ongoing revision process. We're on a quarterly cycle now to review the document and make sure that we're providing the most up-to-date specification and standards that we can. Recently, United States Department of Energy has released a standard work specifications in a draft format. We're reviewing those now. Those will be a national standard. So far, it looks like we're either equal to their standard or ahead of it in terms of the information that we require our workers in the field to work off of. Now, I want to talk about our training and certification programs. That's not one of our classrooms. That's just a... We do operate a U.S. DOE-designated weatherization training center. There are only 14 of those in the country. We're one of them. We use a distributed model, meaning that we take the training out to the field. We have been doing that, like I said, for 30 years. The last several years, we got more sophisticated. We've got trailers. We've got all the equipment. We can conduct any of the training that we conduct any place in the region. Each of our member agencies are considered an extension of the RTC when we're out working. Many of them, we've got continuing relationships with them where we conduct training almost on a regular basis at their locations. And it works really well because we've sort of set up sort of regional locations where people expect to see training being conducted. The programs that we conduct, we've got the OECA Professional Development Program, which is primarily the energy assistance side. We have an energy assistance specialist, and we are now developing an energy assistance manager program. That is grown out of a need within our member network to ensure that with all the new regulations and other requirements that are coming down, that the managers have to manage those programs, understand them, and can stay ahead of the curve in terms of the knowledge required to implement them. Our primary technical program, the Residential Energy Analyst Program, or REAP, we train weatherization workers and supervisors, and we started this past spring an inspector training and certification program. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And then we've got additional related training as necessary. We do mold and mold remediation. We do lead safe work practices. We conduct advanced infrared camera evaluations. And I don't know, I guess there lists all kinds of training that we conduct. But I don't want to take up too much time. But I'm going to focus on the REAP program because that's our flagship training program, and that's really the meat of what we're trying to do. Around 2001-2002, the network got together with OHCS and decided we really need to formalize the training. Up until then, it had been mostly peer training. People would go to the workshop and come back and then conduct an ad hoc meeting with other workers and explain how something was done. So we developed this with OHCS and the OECA membership and several other the people who were in leading edge in building science at the time. And the first classes were actually held at the beginning of 2003. And we've been holding training almost continuously since. So the training and certification is required in the Weatherization Assistance Program state plan. Each agency has to have trained personnel, and many agencies require all the contractors that work with them to also be trained and certified. The Oregon administrative rules require that if under some programs, some of this is fairly new, that if a contractor is going to be doing work, they need to be certified by us to do that. The programs are endorsed by OHCS, ODO, CCB, and the Governor's Green Job Council recently endorsed the use of our program. So our training itself, it meets or exceeds the US DOE core competencies for all the weatherization job categories. They have recently started distributing a curriculum that they've been working on. We have been using that curriculum and comparing it to ours to ensure that we are covering all the pertinent areas that we need to. It turns out that our curriculum has already included this because we stay ahead of the curve, as I said, in the technology and our training methods. One of the unique facets of our training is that not only do we have full-time paid trainers, but we also utilize the workers out in the field who have received our training in the past but are continuing to work on the weatherization projects in the field. When we go out to a location to train, we use a field proctor, so we maintain a particular installer class as a 2-to-1 ratio, and we utilize either the contractor or the agency personnel to assist us in training. Those are the people that are actually doing the work. They're most familiar with the on-the-ground approaches and can bring some good practices, so we really enhance our training with this method. We also actually conduct all of our field exercises in actual houses. Most of them are program houses, meaning they've already gone through the screening for the homeowners to be included in the low-income energy or weatherization assistance programs, and we work with them to conduct the energy audits on the homes and all the diagnostic analysis and make sure that the weatherization measures are installed properly. So with people who are getting trained by us, get some hands-on training in real houses. Since 2003, we've got over 500 separate individuals that we have trained. We've issued over 450 REAP certificates in that same time frame. So we have an awful lot of trained people out there that are, most of them are still in the business. Many of them have gone off to other states and passed our information on to them. So our primary training to get to these certifications, we've got a weatherization fundamentals class, which is a 4-day class that discusses basic building science, basic tools and techniques, and also overall view of the entire program. And the intro class, our weatherization 101, is a complete overview of the entire program, and we highly recommend that for contractors who are interested in getting into the business to understand what it takes, what kind of people they need to have, and what kind of training they should have in order to perform the work properly. We've got two shelf technician classes. One of them focuses on stick-built housing. The other one focuses on mobile homes. Because we do deal with low-income communities, a vast majority of our clients that our agencies work with live in mobile homes, and those are in many cases need a lot of work to become energy efficient. So we have a specific training program just for that. And we also conduct training on energy analysts, diagnostic technicians, a crew leader, and the weatherization inspectors. Having that training, you can result in various certifications. There are fundamentals certs to show that you've attended those classes, and in each of the other trainings, you would need to take both Shell Tech classes to get the Shell Technician certification. It's pretty intense training that works out to about 2 weeks, both classroom and field work.
Excuse me just for a minute,
yes,
Representative Dembrough.
Jim, could you give us a sense? You've mentioned the duration of a couple of those programs. You know, one was 4 days, one was 2 weeks. How long are the others?
Oh, sure. Let me back up and go through those.
Thanks.
Well, the weatherization fundamentals is a total of 4 days right now. We're actually going to be adding an additional class so that everybody who goes through that will end up with an OSHA 10-hour card. The Shell Technician classes are each one full day in the classroom and then 2 days in the field, and each of those have a half-day written exam that goes with that. The Energy Analyst is and the Diagnostic Technician, those are both 2 full days of classroom and 2 full days in the field, and then an additional half-day for a written exam. The crew leader is a full day in the classroom and a full day in the field, including some additional classroom work, and then a half day for a written exam. And the inspector class is also a full day in the classroom and then a combination of classroom and field work for another day and then a half day training. In fact, we've got an inspector class going on right now, and I would imagine that the guys are in their second house right now. We try to get at least 2 houses for each of these trainings. And we keep the student-to-teacher ratio low. The inspector classes are 4-to-1. The Shell Technician classes are the installer classes, and we try to keep those at 2-to-1, no more than 3-to-1, primarily because people are working on a job site, and this makes sure that the training team has adequate control and are able to work with each of the trainees on more of a 1-to-1 basis. All the field exercises that are conducted have to be conducted at a level of 100%, and that means that the trainees will continue to do the field exercises until they get them right. They have to be able to do them right before they can graduate.
That's
the written exams all require a 75% to pass, and they are all open book. The reason being is we have an awful lot of questions that require them to understand what's in the technical specifications or in the field guides or any of the other materials that we give them during training. We expect them to be able to find this. In many cases, the questions that we ask are specifically designed to require the trainee to look the information up, make calculations, and determine what the answer would be. So it's a pretty intense three-hour exam. So did that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So back to the certifications then. We've got the last two are not specific to a training program. The SEAL requires the individual to have been working full-time in the position for 5 years. They have to be certified in all the previous certs. And they do basically, it's a two-day test, totally closed book, where they have to go out and complete a complete audit on a house, including the computer modeling, complete a work plan for the house, and then they take a four-hour written exam. They need to get 85% on all of those aspects in order to get SEAL. We've only have five of those people are in the state right now. Only five people have achieved that certification. But they definitely know their stuff, I can tell you that. Contractor accreditation is something that we've just recently rolled out, and that kind of gets us to the next thing I want to talk about is our accreditation program. Contractor accreditation, there's two endorsements. One is for weatherization auditors, and one is for weatherization installers. And what we're trying to do with that is to make sure that the contractors who are doing the work are recognized for the quality of the work that they do and the quality of the training and the fact that they are maintaining certification of their employees. And one other aspect is that we require them, in order to maintain that accreditation, to have 100% inspection of their work by somebody who does not work for them. The industrial program, we're working with several workforce agencies around the state to develop training avenues for to move people into weatherization programs. We're working with apprenticeship training programs and union training trust to develop REAP accreditation for their programs so they can continue to train the same level that we do. Our academic programs are actually coming together quicker than I thought we would. We've been working with Clackamas Community College, Central Oregon Community College, Lane Community College, and we've just now started working with Chemeketa Community College. With Clackamas, they're developing a two-year program, and we have started the paperwork to get our all our courses accredited for college credits. And hopefully we'll have that completed in the next 2 to 3 months, so every time we conduct REAP training, trainees will be able to earn college credits through a Clackamas Community College.
We're also working... Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Representative Holby.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious about the... you know, you say these are state-certified programs, so is the, and I know, I see an apprenticeship and training division in the audience, are they certified with the apprenticeship and training division as well?
No, we haven't gotten to that point. We've been working with some of the apprenticeship programs on what we need to do that. Some of these we're still developing, and primarily the apprenticeship training program is one we're still working on.
A follow-up. I'm curious with this weatherization, which apprenticeship programs and union training trusts that you're working with?
We're working with the Northwest College of Construction and the Clackamas Community College. Both are apprenticeship programs. We've been talking to them about what we need to do to develop that. The Union Training Trust, we've been working with the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA. The local trust is the, I always get this wrong, Oregon and Southern Idaho Laborers and Employers Training Trust, OSILET. Yeah. They actually operate the a training center down in Albany.
Follow up,
please.
And the work processes that you're training in, I'm just weatherization installer. Can you describe to me what that is? Is that, and your weatherization auditor, is that weather stripping? Is it insulation?
Well, it's all of that. What the auditor does is it usually takes about a four-hour minimum time frame in a house, and the auditor goes in and does a complete walkthrough, measures the house out, measures the windows, takes an assessment of the heating and ventilation system in the house, determines the basic construction of it, goes into the crawl spaces up in the attics, does a visual inspection throughout, then sets up diagnostic equipment, including a blower door, duct blaster, if there's a ventilation system in the house, and evaluates where air leakage may be, where insulation is in the house, uses infrared cameras to conduct some of the analysis, and several other diagnostic tools. If there are combustion appliances in the house, they also check for backdrafting, check for CO in the air. They check for proper combustion of the equipment, make sure that they are, in fact, tuned up and cleaned up and whatever else needs to be done, and conducts an assessment of the house as a whole breathing system, so to speak. And then they take the information and run it through a computer modeling program that identifies, comparing it against specifications, compares the house to those standards to determine where it makes sense to install insulation or do weather stripping, or whether there needs to be any duct sealing conducted or any additional air sealing in the house, and then comes up with a plan of attack. Then the installers will take that work plan and whatever the auditor and the analyst have decided together that need to be conducted will install the weatherization measures on the house. And generally, that's air sealing, duct sealing, attic insulation. It could be a dense pack insulation in the walls. It may be underfloor insulation. There may be some additional duct insulation. There may be actual furnace replacement, or other appliances may need to be replaced because they're not efficient or they're causing problems. If there are wood stoves or any other combustion units in the house, fireplaces or whatnot, they take those all into account and determine whether they're all functioning properly.
Representative Colby.
Follow up, please. So I kind of get the gist of that. I'm just kind of curious how that fits in with current standards for apprenticeship training, you know, whether, you know, the furnace work and all that's, I think that's, you know, whether those apprenticeship programs or those training programs that you have that in their standards, is that the work that they perform in that, like insulating? I would imagine you're working with the insulating unions or whatnot, so it's in their training standards that are already established?
That's what we're working with, and because we have grown out of the low-income weatherization programs funded by USDOE, they require each state to come up with a plan on how they're going to implement the weatherization program. Over the years, we've developed these specifications. They're pretty extensive. They cover practically everything that you would do on a house. And what we are trying to do now is make sure that those specifications that we believe are the leading edge in the industry, to utilize those throughout the rest of the community, not just low-income housing. We think everybody needs to be training to these same standards and needs to be installing weatherization measures to the same standards. So we're working with the unions and we're working with the other apprenticeship programs to develop programs within their programs that will conduct training. In fact, we trained the two trainers that LIUNA have down in Albany. We sent them through our ShellTech last year, so they understood that. They had, you know, they're great carpenters, fantastic trainers, really know their stuff. But in terms of weatherization techniques, they weren't familiar with those at all. And so we worked with them, and part of what we've done is we've hooked them up with some of our agencies that run their own crews, and they've been going out on the job sites with the crews and understanding what it takes out in the field to actually do this work, and hopefully they're bringing it back to their training sessions as they gear up to do weatherization training within their training trust.
Thank you for that explanation, but I think you maybe missed my point. Is I would think that those training programs and those training apprenticeship programs you're working with have a set of standards in the work processes that they train in that are already identified by, I believe, the Bureau of Labor and Industries in their apprenticeship and training documents. And so I'm curious whether you're putting this out to you know, anybody that wants to train in this field, or whether they're like you're training laborers to do insulating work or doing furnace evaluations and work. And it seems like there's other unions that already have that type of training in their established standards. I'm not sure that the laborers union actually has those standards in their training processes. So I'm kind of confused by that.
Well, they basically came to us and said, show us how to do this because we want to teach it. And so we said, sure, we'll be happy to help you. And that's what we're doing. If they already have a program in place for training, we want to coordinate with them to make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of the techniques that they're using. Maybe we can certainly learn from them as well. Hopefully we can teach them something as well. But we've been approached by several contractors as far as the apprenticeship training program goes, asking us if there is any movement afoot to develop an apprenticeship training program in the weatherization field, because there's nothing in there right now. As you do point out, there are bits and pieces, like insulators or HVAC.
Let me make this a little bit more clear, perhaps. So, say, for example, you're going to train people on how to do the electronics and the electrical work, so you're going to start training carpenters and laborers and cement masons how to do the electrical work through their apprenticeship programs. And I don't think that those standards are already established in an apprenticeship program, but not that one. And so I'm a little confused how you're going out broadly like that and, ignoring. So you're going to train laborers how to do electrical work and...
No, we're not training laborers to do electrical work.
I'm making a point, though. You're training laborers to do HVAC work, it sounds like, or evaluating furnaces and such. So I'm a little bit concerned about where you're going.
We're training auditors to evaluate combustion appliances in general. In terms of installing them or replacing them, that's still up to contractors who do installation and replacement of those appliances. We just evaluate them to make sure that they're working properly.
It just seems, follow up, Mr. Chair, apologize. It just seems to me that you would be working with the current processes and standards that are established.
That's what we're doing. Perhaps I wasn't clear. We're working with these to make sure that whatever we're doing fits in with their programs, and whatever they'd like to do, in particular, anything that has to do with weatherization, that they're working with us on that. We're just trying to make sure that we're all on the same page.
It's an interesting precedent, perhaps, I think. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I was confusing.
Mr. Dawson, to help me to clarify where I'm at on this, and I guess to follow up on Representative Holvey's line of questioning, have you ever been asked to provide training for any of the licensed crafts in the state?
No, we've not.
Thank you.
And we don't intend to, unless they want us to. So I think that pretty much covers that. What do we got next? We have been working on national initiatives with the USDOE, in particular the standard work specifications that we talked about, standardized curricula, worker certification. They're providing guidelines on that. Oregon is one of only five states in the country that have statewide weatherization training and certification programs. There are many that have weatherization training. Many of them use other certifications. Many don't do any certification at all. There are several states that are just now really coming up to speed in terms of the latest technology. So what DOE has been doing is talking to us along with the other four states that have these certifications to find out how we did it and how we're maintaining the program so that they can incorporate our ideas and our experience into the national program. This, they assure us that it will not be a national requirement for certification. They're going to be providing guidelines, and we're helping them to develop those guidelines. The other thing that USDOE will be doing is a formal training center accreditation program. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But they will only be accrediting designated DOE weatherization training centers, so we'll be one of those. The other is a national training platform in which we can interact via the internet with other training centers to develop additional curriculum and additional training materials that will be available throughout the nation. And the beta version that they've developed is actually pretty amazing. They went out and spent money and hired actual gaming programmers who know how to do this stuff. So we could conceivably come up with some online training that looks like somebody's playing Halo 3 or something. And that's just repeating what I just said, that we are working actively with them to make sure that our state programs are incorporated. So our program goals right now are conformance with national standards. The two that have been selected by USDOE, the ANSI 17024, which is a personnel certification body, because we do work with OHCS on this certification, we're working on how exactly we meet the requirements. And the ISP standard 01022, that's for training programs that are working with energy efficiency, which is what we come under. The USDOE is going to be adopting that, making some changes to it, and they intend on the beginning of the first of the year to start self-assessment. That's actually a project that we had already started this past summer before DOE had announced that they're going to be using the standard. We think that we meet somewhere around 80-85% of the requirements, and most of the ones that we don't meet are primarily paperwork, documentation, reporting type requirements that the ISP requires for this standard. And then, of course, we want to make sure that we're always in alignment with the USD National Certification and Accreditation Guidelines, and so far we're one of the few states that are at that point.
Mr. Dawson, I hate to interrupt here, but out of respect for our other witnesses today, can you shorten your presentation a little bit?
I sure can.
Thank you.
Let me see where we can jump to. Okay, I can buzz through most of the rest of this here. This was the primary reason I'm here, to talk about this project. So a very brief overview. It is a weatherization training center grant from USDOE. We got $1 million of it, and they distributed 19 or 29 million of it nationally. We put together our application with a group that we're calling the Weatherization Energy Training Alliance. Basically, the people in the Northwest that are interested in training for energy efficiency and weatherization, or they're doing that now. And this is how we kind of got into the apprenticeship program. People are interested in doing this training. We're trying to coordinate efforts all around the region. The grant is not only to help us do that in Oregon, but also in Washington, Idaho as well. So that was a working group that we pulled out of that original group about a year ago to put the application together. You can see we had several colleges on there, and we also let, and of course all of our members were part of the operation. Basically, the project is to expand our training throughout the region to expand outside low-income programs by adding people, equipment, building up existing facilities, and seeing what else we need to get the programs rolling. The primary objectives are, as we've been talking, expanding the training capacity, more training options, standardize the training and specifications around the region, and to furnish the RTC. The idea is that we're increasing the capacity throughout the region so that as additional programs come online and there are more possibilities of people getting their houses weatherized, we'll be able to train the people that need to go out and do the work. And the big thing here, we're trying to minimize duplication of effort, which is why we're trying to get as many people at the table as we possibly can. There's certainly efficiencies of scale in doing that. And a lot of this is repetitive, but this is all right out of the grant language, and I wanted to make sure that we got a chance to go through any of this if necessary. One of the items is some more research. There's always research that can be done. There's always new materials coming out, and that's one of the functions we want to do that's kind of unavailable at this point. There's no place to go to find out if that insulation is as good as the manufacturer says. So we will be issuing some sub-grants in addition to direct contracts. Any sub-recipients have to meet the exact grantee requirements that we have to meet, and they've got to come up with a 25% cost match just as we do. And primary to any issuing any sub-grants, they need to make sure they're going to meet all those objectives and outcomes, which is we sort of buzzed through just now. This is actually kind of critical here. The second item must be spent to train workers how to weatherize low-income housing. There are some issues initially with this. U.S. DOE wanted to limit the grant money strictly to the official weatherization assistance programs, and after much discussion, it was the work was defined to train workers on to weatherize low-income housing. That's an important point because there are many low-income programs out there, and many of them have varying qualification requirements. And this way, we don't have to figure out which qualification requirements need to be met. If the program is self-identified as a low-income program and they have housing that needs to be weatherized, and if somebody is trained by us, they can go work on that housing and they've met the requirements of the program. So there's no specific program that's defined. There's no threshold definition of low-income housing,
yeah.
And there's no threshold definition of the amount of work required, because we really, once we train somebody, we can't require them to only work on low-income housing. So, you know, people have to make a living, obviously. So they should be able to go work wherever it is. As long as they are doing the work, trained to the standards that were required for the low-income weatherization programs, as we taught them. So this was the budget that we're working off of. To give you an idea, those are actually lumped together. If you can see, about $650,000 of that is going to be labor-related, and including travel and other costs associated with that. The rest of that, about $200,000 of it, is for additional equipment and supplies, and the balance, about $450,000, is for subcontracts and subgrants. Our match is $250,000 to that, so that's why the total project is a 1.25. So the status, as you can tell, we're kind of under construction still on the project. We've got six primary tasks that have been identified. The first one, updating the project management plan, is an ongoing process. We post all of our documents, and in fact, this PowerPoint will also be posted on the website. Just click on the wet cap link and you'll go right to everything. We've got all the contract documents there, all our meeting notes and everything. So the first task is a ramp up, and then we've got an outreach task, and then the last three tasks are all related because they're all program or training tasks. So ramp up, that's kind of how we're doing it right now. We have lots and lots of things that we're trying to ramp up all at once. I've kind of lumped them all into three broad categories. That's staffing. We need to get people on board to help with all of this work that we're going to do. We've got to identify what subgrants we need and get that application process completed. We're close to getting that ready to go. And we need to identify all the equipment and other supply needs for all the other tasks. And this is an ongoing process, obviously. Next big task is outreach.
Mr. Dawson, I'm sorry, sir, but can you put a wrap on this in the next couple of minutes, please?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
We've got a statewide and a regional plan. We are working with non-low-income weatherization programs, professional associations. We're working with the state codes and licensing folks. Regionally, we're working with Washington and Idaho and other organizations. And our training tasks are basically those: to add personnel, we need to locate a central facility so we can grow and deliver the training that we're doing. These are our expectations over the next 3 years: to train approximately 1,000 weatherization workers in Oregon. We want to accredit 100 contracting firms to ensure that they're doing the work properly, complete our college accreditation process, and we'd like to accredit at least one REAP training center that is not ours in each state. Now I can take questions. So that was pretty quick.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Just a quick question.
Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Just quickly, Jim, where does your 1,000 training number come from?
That is boiled down from some expectations that we've been hearing from folks that have been developing new programs and how many trainees they expect are going to be needed in order for their programs to be involved. One of them is the EAST program. The other one would be Clean Energy Works Oregon, and there's some others, local programs that we've been looking at, and we've actually scaled that down. When we first applied, the hard numbers we were hearing based on the national initiatives that, as we all know, have been put on the back burner now, they're talking 5,000 to 6,000 people in Oregon that need to be trained in the three-year time frame. Reality is that about 1,000 over the next 3 years are going to be needed if these programs ramp up the way they're supposed to. So this is why it's just our expectations at this point. As we move forward in the next year, we'll have a much better handle on how many people we're actually going to need to train to make sure that we've got a good workforce to get this work done.
Thanks. Additional questions or comments for Mr. Dawson? Anyone? Thank you very, very much, sir. I appreciate that.
Thank you, gentlemen. I apologize to everybody coming behind me for taking up time.
Okay. Thank you. Before we proceed to our next presenter, I noticed that we have a number of representatives from the apprenticeship community in the audience, and I'm just interested to know if there's anyone from that community that would wish to say, make a couple of brief comments at this point. Not trying to obligate anyone, but just want to offer that opportunity.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Witt, committee members. Stephen Sims, S-I-M-M-S. I'm the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And we are aware that representatives of REAP have talked with some of our apprenticeship programs in the state, and that's a good thing. Just about every one of the building trades, to some degree, is currently involved in some form of weatherization work. It is what they do. That work covers a variety of different jurisdictions. You know, there's electrical work involved, there's plumbing work, there's boiler work, there's laborers work, there's carpentry work. That's one reason why there is not a universal apprenticeship program for weatherization. Weatherization on its own could be looked at as a subcategory of every single apprenticeable occupation. What is happening right now is some of the trades are trying to develop their own weatherization programs and keeping it limited to the scope of what their trade is, to their existing jurisdiction. That's difficult. This creates a single worker that does all that work. I don't know how that's going to work on public works projects where they're covered by the prevailing wage law. But the good thing is there are resources out there. I think REAP does have some assets that they could bring to the apprenticeship program to help them improve the quality of their training since they're specializing in weatherization techniques. But again, I believe a lot of this is going to eventually be covered within the scope of existing apprenticeship programs.
Steve, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate that. Questions or comments for Mr. Sims? Thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Last and final call for any additional public comment. Okay, folks, thank you. Next up is Agnes Balassa from the Oregon Workforce Partnership. Welcome back to our subcommittee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Witt and members of the committee. And it is nice to be back. This time I'm in a very different capacity than the last time I spoke before you when I was with the National Skills Coalition. Today I'm representing the Oregon Workforce Partnership, which is the association of the seven local workforce boards in Oregon. It's like a trade association of the local workforce boards. They band together through Oregon Workforce Partnership to share information with each other, to continually improve what they do, and to also look at the issues that affect workforce across the state as opposed to their local perspectives. Which is where each one of them, of course, spends most of their time. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be before you today.
I'm sorry, Agnes. I want to interrupt first. It's kind of, with Jim speaking before you and knowing what we've been working on the last year and a half on Green Jobs Council and Oregon Workforce Investment Board, has with the, I forget what Greg calls it now, but we affectionately refer to it as the CESPE grant.
Mm-hmm.
And the monies that came out of that for training 1,100 weatherization professionals. Is Jim involved in that in his program at the training center, or is it is it totally separate? I just want to get that out of my mind and clarify.
You know, I would have to defer to Greg on that.
Greg, would you mind?
Well, I was involved in the original development of that proposal. I certainly have not been closely associated with it since that point. So.
Representative Huffman, Chair Witt, members of the committee, Greg White, executive staff to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Excuse me. That grant, $5.38 million, is not exclusively to train weatherization. That's one of the occupations being trained for, and I don't have the exact numbers with me. Okay. I can get them to you. But basically, especially in the Community Services Consortium, which is Benton Lincoln Counties, it's very closely aligned with exactly what Mr. Dawson was talking about. That's where their training center is located, and they're the ones who are working with the Laborers Union, the LIUNA program, and they are training both energy auditors and weatherization installers through that grant. I would imagine that there are linkages between the two grants. I can't tell you what they are.
Okay.
But I do want to tell you that the CESP grant is not exclusively for weatherization training. There's a lot of stuff in there that's other kinds of green occupations.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Okay.
Sorry, continue.
Not a problem. My understanding is that today what you all as a committee were interested in was hearing about our white paper, the Oregon Workforce Partnership's white paper on workforce development. And so that's what I've come prepared to present. However, if it's the will of the committee to focus on some other aspects of the work that we do, I'm very happy to entertain what other questions you may have.
Yes, thank you.
All right. So do I start the presentation here or? So, as part of the work of the Oregon Workforce Partnership, back last summer, the group agreed that it was time. Let me adjust this slide. I'm sorry. Let me get it up running for you first, and then I'll talk. There we go. The association agreed last summer that it was time that we took a comprehensive look at workforce development and the needs of workforce development in the current economic environment. And so this white paper is a result of that work. It was our effort to paint a comprehensive picture of workforce development because very often we focus only on the federally funded programs that are administered through the local workforce systems, and we felt it was important to have a larger conversation. As members of the Oregon Workforce Partnership, we also spend a lot of time interacting with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And so a lot of the priorities that the Oregon Workforce Investment Board has identified over the course of the last several years also are reflected in this paper. The paper was endorsed by the National Skills Coalition as well as Manufacturing 21. And in the interest of time, I'll skip through a few things just to move you to the main points here. Really, we were looking at this challenge of a jobless recovery and this idea of a new normal with high rates of long-term unemployment. Recent research that showed that our per capita personal income had slid to 90% of the U.S. average. And this growing number of 99ers, which are people who have been unemployed for 99 weeks or more, so almost 2 years. That was the backdrop of the economic crisis, and I know I don't need to spend a lot of time explaining just how dire it's become. The other thing that was really critical to us was a recognition that today's learners are working learners. They are not people who go directly from high school to college in many cases. They come back over and over and over again. I know none of this is news to you as a workforce committee. And so part of our goal was to look at how do you make sure that their needs are also met. And our answer was that what you really need is a robust and comprehensive system of educational programs and supports. In this economy, training alone doesn't do it. And our belief is, long term, our economy has seen some shifts so that while training is still the e-ticket, by itself, it's no longer getting people where they need to be. And so we need additional supports that further expand this. We need to be focusing more and more on learn and earn opportunities, not unlike apprenticeships being the e-ticket there, but additional ways for people to be able to skill up while still earning a paycheck, and that our number one priority had to be on focusing on people getting back to work as soon as possible.
Angus, can you bore down on those 99ers? Do you have any demographic information or anything like that?
I have a little bit of that. I want to say we're at about 30,000 Oregonians that are on at that point that have fallen off the cliff of unemployment insurance. What we know is the bulk of them are male. bulk of them come from traditionally male occupations, construction, manufacturing, a smattering of other occupations, but that's where the vast majority of them are coming from right now, and those are two of our sectors that are struggling with the recovery right now, construction especially, manufacturing doing a little better, especially because there are some replacement jobs in manufacturing right now, but that's the bulk of it comes from for Oregon.
Anything, you have any information on age, urban, rural, anything like that?
I don't have an urban-rural breakdown. They tend to be, age-wise, I think it's that 20 to 40-year-old bracket, but I'd have to double-check that. Off the top of my head, I'm just not positive.
Thank you.
But what was startling about it is how very male and how very construction-oriented and that is. It bears out what we keep hearing. So.
Thank you.
The other thing that we came and talked to you all about a year and a half ago, was this whole idea about middle-skill jobs, the fact that even with our challenging economy right now, there are still companies recruiting for these jobs that are having difficulty filling them. And so that's why I say training is still critical in here. It's not enough right now as companies are waiting for the ideal employee. A few years back, we could just train them and train them and train them, and companies were saying, bring them on, keep filling it in. Today, they're saying even with a trained person, they want something more to be sure that they have the right skill sets. So we came up with three components to this solution. Of course, the first one is always growing jobs. And we're very clear that workforce development does not grow jobs. Workforce development responds to the growth in jobs. However, we are interested in a conversation about whether there's ways to pair, as the legislature looks at economic incentives, are there ways to pair that with workforce development incentives to assure that as new industries are incented to grow, or as current industries are incented to grow, that there is also a workforce development component that goes hand in hand in that, so that we don't end up with jobs that we can't fill. The second component was about aligning education and workforce programs to create a more comprehensive system, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this one. But career pathways was a big guiding principle, this concept that people can get pieces of information at the right time, pieces of education at the right time for the right length to move them to the next step, and then you can continue to build from there. Whether they start with an apprenticeship program, whether they start with an educational program, whether they start with an entry-level job, regardless of where they start, that the education should be organized in such a way that it's not necessarily about 2 years of training. It's about the right skill set to move you to the next step of your career. And the community colleges have been doing a lot of work around this. We also focused on some of the pieces that you don't hear about so much, adult basic education. For example, we've seen through the assessment that we're doing in our WorkSource centers that approximately 40% of the people that are coming through WorkSource Oregon do not have the math skills that are required for 65% of the jobs out there. About 35 to 40% in that range, but I think it's right around 37%, do not have the reading skills that they need. And so basic skills was a key component for us. These are unemployed workers. They've been making money. They've been employed, and now they're suddenly unemployed, and we're recognizing that their basic skills are such that they have to be skilled up before they can even take advantage of training. We also focused on the wraparound services that are necessary. We also focused on other types, and I'll talk a little bit more about three approaches there, of other types of programming that we think are critical. And then the last piece was ensuring that investments align to meet the needs of business and industry. Local workforce boards are charged with a coordinating function for federal programs. The question was, could they do more to better align even broader arrays of services?
Agnes, if I could interrupt, please, Representative Esquivel.
Just one quick question. You just gave us some statistical information on people with the lack of knowledge when it comes to mathematics, when it comes to reading. And I know it's comprehension and blah, you know, it just goes, the hits just keep on coming,
yes,
out of our K-12 system. Do you have any information on how many of those people graduated out of high school with a diploma? Because that would be very interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. I do not have that at my fingertips. We do know that in terms of the population that comes through WorkSource Oregon.
Example, you just quoted, you know, a certain percentage of them can't do math, certain percentage of them can't do adequate reading skills. Are those high school graduates or are they people that have dropped out of the system? I would like to know that.
Representative Esquivel, they're both. What I don't have is the proportion.
I would like to have that if you have that available.
And I will check with, Karen, do you have it right now?
No.
Okay. Karen Putmobile, who is here with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, that's the agency that keeps all that information.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't have the specifics there, but I do know it's a mix of both. And I do know in some cases it is the fact that they haven't used those skills for a period of time, especially the math. The math is very challenged that way. In some cases, a brief skill brush-up will get them further. In some cases, they need much more extensive coursework.
And Representative Dembro, I think that's a question.
The points I was going to make, thanks, Mr. Chair, Agnes just made, that it really is a combination. And, you know, a number of people in the past could drop out of high school, go into construction, and do that for a while. Other people graduated with, you know, okay skills, but haven't been reading, haven't been doing math for many years. And so, you know, it's a process to get back to it. You take that initial test, you may not have experience with test taking, and that's going to be a problem. So it's mm-hmm. really a mix, I think.
Yes. So I'm going to focus a little bit more on this career pathways conversation that we just started. What you see in the middle here is what traditionally a career pathway looks like. We've added two pieces to that conversation that we think are critical for some future conversation. One is the National Career Readiness Certificate, which is an assessment of skills. It's an actual certification of skills. And through the WorkSource Centers and community colleges, this assessment is being provided to people so that they can actually prove what level of skill they have and document that they are able to read, locate information, and do mathematics at an adequate level so that employers can see what skill sets they have. There is another piece in here. We talk about the MicroPel, the fact that financing for education is very difficult when you're taking small chunks of education. And while that's a national issue, that's something that at some point we recognize as a long-term goal. At some point we'd like to talk more with Oregon about the financing mechanism, too, and ways to make that more flexible. We wrap this around with WorkSource Centers because typically when we talk about career pathways, we miss the piece of the WorkSource Centers. 280,000 people per year come through WorkSource Centers, and as part of that, they get information on how to move in and out of these systems as they're becoming more developed. And then on top of that, of course, you've got a community college system. We use industry input through the local workforce boards and then some oversight for some components. We also have a more integrated system within WorkSource. One of the things we did 2 years ago as we were seeing this challenge of more highly skilled individuals was to redesign WorkSource in order to provide more skill development training there. So instead of people just coming through and starting with a job search, now they come through and get that initial assessment we just talked about so that they know what their skills are and know if they need to improve them. And we're building a much more comprehensive menu of services for them to be able to connect to once they have a better sense of skills, because that's always been a missing component of their work. Our solution three was around the alignment through the utilization of the federally required local planning function that local work boards provide to try to see if we can get even more programs aligned and even more support for the programs that the economy can support in communities. So we were asked to prioritize our goals for this two-year period. To try to figure out if this is a long-term vision and a long-term agenda that's shared by many, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, by us, by community colleges, by others, what would we put on the table as things that could be accomplished in the next 2 to 3 years that would make a difference? And the reality is we have 200,000 people unemployed right now. Our economy is making about 30,000 jobs every 6 months to a year. We've got a huge crisis there. So we tried to pick things recognizing that we've got this current crisis in the economy, that anything that we recommend would have to be low cost to no cost, knowing that there's just no new revenue, and that there had to be a high return on investment, which meant for us turning unemployed people into employed people while gaining skills wherever possible, putting money into people's pockets, and also making sure that it helped the competitiveness of industry. And then we had to look at anything with proven results. This was not a time to create brand new programs. There's no money for creating new things that aren't untested right now. So we came up with a couple of immediate opportunities. The first, of course, is this increasing alignment, because it's a very low cost to no cost proposition in that you can increase alignment without having to add a whole lot of money and then figure out how to use that planning process to get greater leverage. So that was our first one. The second one was looking at three programs that met our criteria Current workforce training is one because people already have paychecks in that case, and the goal is to keep them employed as opposed to allowing them to become unemployed. And Oregon is one of 30 states that doesn't have an investment in current worker training. We use some federal dollars, and that federal pot is getting harder and harder to use as the Department of Labor is adding restrictions on how to use that resource. This was a program that was originally created by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and has really helped a lot of companies stay competitive during this crisis. Youth Employment Program, I don't remember if we talked to you all about this last year, but I'll just really quickly describe that. It was a program to take youth and get them employed over the summer while earning college credits. What we found was that a large number of these youth actually needed the resource, not just because they wanted to work, but because they were actually helping to support their families. And for every dollar that we invested in this program, we got $1.46 of return on investment from the youth program, especially out in Eastern Oregon. And then on the job training, I apologize, I should have proofed this before I put it up there, I'm sorry. On the job training program, paired with the credentials, one I'm going to talk a little bit more about, because it's the one that's hardest to understand out of the three. On-the-job training is one of the programs that we are able to fund through federal dollars. It's just a challenge to fund a lot of it. What we have found in the last year as we focused more on this program is that it's actually one of the few ways we're getting placements right now. Workforce boards, the WorkSource system, is investing a lot of money in training right now. We're getting a lot of people who are getting great skills programs, and we're still not able to place them. And one of the reasons is the hesitancy employers have until they have the right mix of hiring and the recognition that even once they hire, they're still going to have to train people for their specific jobs. So, for example, if we have an unemployed someone who's unemployed from manufacturing who's changing fields, has gone through training, will the employer take a chance on somebody who's freshly trained who hasn't had industry experience? We found the on-the-job training program can make a difference. It's a hire-first program, so it's not a wage subsidy or a temporary work service. It's a hire-first program. The company agrees to hire the individual, and then the company is reimbursed for the cost of training the individual. So the individual has to meet most of their criteria anyway, but the company gets a small reimbursement during the first 6 months of the employee's time there as a way to cover the cost of the training. And then upon retention, they get their second payment to create the whole program. We felt that it was important to pair that program with a credential, because one of the challenges of an on-the-job training program versus community college training versus certificate programs is there is no certification at the end. And so the National Career Readiness Certificate, the certificate that proves people's basic skills, would be paired with this program to assure that people have the skills not only to succeed in the training, that they have the basic skills to make it in the training, but also to advance and to continue to benefit from training. And so this was one of the things that we saw as having a lot of promise for the upcoming session. Youth employment I've talked about a little bit, and I think it's one that most people are more familiar with. It's an amazing program in terms of the return we get from youth having work experience, because there's no good way to get work experience except through work experience, and no one wants to hire a youth right now. It's one of the few ways to keep us from losing this next generation. You have economists talk about the lost generation. It's all those 16 to 25-year-olds that nobody wants to hire right now because they've got much more mature, more skilled workers out there. Current worker training, we talked a little bit about. This is also something where we figure it's much cheaper to keep someone employed than to have them lose a job. So what happened was Senator Schrader, before the elections, had read our white paper and become very interested in it. And she had asked us to package up these ideas for her, and she put them forward as legislative concepts. Senator Rosenbaum, has actually put them forward and moved them through the process, so that's why you have legislative concept numbers with them right now. And so they have actually been developed into proposals. Those are the numbers on the proposals. They're awaiting next steps at this point. Our long-term solution clearly is career pathways and greater investment there and an adequate investment in the entire array of services. These were our short-term crisis economy recommendations, knowing that it's unlikely that all three of them could even move forward, but these were the things that seemed to make most sense. And I just wanted to pull out a couple of slides that Graham Slater had shared with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board just last Friday. that I think help with understanding this whole dynamic that we have right now. Even though the massive job loss is over and we see jobs being created, you can see that about 6,000 jobs were created in October. Almost as many jobs were created again this month in November, which is a very, very strong sign. Still, when they did their vacancy survey and they saw that over 30,000 vacancies would be available in Oregon, you still have almost 200,000 unemployed people waiting for those opportunities. And that's a 6.3 to 1 ratio of unemployed people to opportunity right now. This was the piece that I thought was most interesting, and one of the reasons why a program like on-the-job training could work right now is that when you look at the dark lines on the right-hand side of the slide, those are new jobs being created. When you look at the red lines on the left-hand side of the slide, those are the people who've been displaced by those industries. So what you see is a lot of people who already have skills. For some of these industries, they don't need a lot of retraining, but they will need newer versions of those skills as companies have changed the way they do business, as they've changed staffing patterns, and as people have sat on the bench sometimes for more than 2 years. The problem with skills are they're use them or lose them. And so the longer people sit on unemployment, the harder it is for them to get back, not only because of a perception that they've actually lost skills, but because actual research shows that if you're not using those skills, you actually start to atrophy them. And so this was one of those pieces that just caught my attention, I thought might be worth sharing with you all as part of our presentation. Here's my contact information if you have any questions. But that's my brief summary of our white paper. There's a lot more in it than what we're putting forward right now. This was just our short-term answer to this immediate situation that we're facing.
Thank you, Agnes. Any questions or comments at the dais? Representative Holby?
Thank you. I was just curious if we could get a copy of your slides. It looks like it's on a PowerPoint or something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I can also forward the link to Graham Slater's full presentation where you have all the information about...
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I can provide a link to that as well.
One of the things on the next to the last slide where you had mostly red on the left side, mm-hmm. black on the right side, you'll notice that on the left side there were some black marks, which
yes.
meant that job losses are not complete, and they're projecting additional losses through
yes.
2011 there in certain categories. So that's part of the additional not-so-good news on that slide.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll notice on the top where healthcare is. Healthcare is one of the few fields where you haven't seen the amount of dislocation, and so there's a place where training still is definitely your answer, because if you look at the growth potential there versus the bench, the people sitting on the bench, there's not a lot of people on the bench. So that is a place where clearly training is the answer, and that is a place where on-the-job training often doesn't substitute for certifications and other forms of documentation that you've gotten the skills that you need.
You made a slight point there on... Karen and some others last Friday at Oregon Workforce Investment Board meeting had a little more expanded pitch on it, but it was one of the things that really caught my attention, and I made a comment on it that a year or two ago I had made a comment in a hearing that if part of our goal was to skill unemployed people up, can't we start requiring them to do assessments and figure out where they are in their level of education or in need, and that's become a part of the when you enter the employment office now as an unemployed person, you take the assessment and figure out where you are. The name of the assessment, I know you're not Karen,
WIN,
but
the WIN assessment.
Yeah, the WIN assessment.
I can answer that for you. Okay.
The WIN assessment,
the initial skills review, yes.
So I was excited to find out that we are requiring some of that now of people entering so that they know best how to help them in the employment department find work and then hopefully be able to guide them to different skilling up programs.
Right. And just, you know, I've referred to it as WorkSource Oregon. WorkSource Oregon is employment department staff as well as some federally funded, what they call Workforce Investment Act Title I B staff that work together with other partners to try to help get people back to work. So we're talking about the same system, just different ways of framing it.
Well, did we, yes, Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. This whole conversation about you know, finding ways to promote certification and, you know, while keeping people working, you know, I think is really important. And it parallels a conversation that's happening in the general world of higher education having to do with promoting completion of certificate or degree. You know, that there are a lot of students, a lot of former students out there who were lured away from their studies by the availability of jobs, have a bunch of courses, but have no degree or no certification to show for it. And, you know, one of the things that a number of states are looking at are ways of making it easier for those students to repackage all of their accomplishments and come up with some certification. One of the really key ingredients to that, I think, is a sense from employers that they really value certification. And it sounds like you're hearing more of that out in the field. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure.
And what do we need to do, really, to get that word out that employers value completion, they value certification, and then to make that a priority?
It's a great question, Representative Dembrough. You know, so my experience in working with employers is they tend to be very clear about the skill sets that they want, but they're not always clear about how academic credentials relate to those. And they often lump certification in as part of academic credentials. There are industries where they're extremely clear. You know what kind of a certification you need for an accountant or for a CNA or for a welder. You know, so there are industries where they're extremely clear. But generally speaking, especially smaller employers that need more of a jack-of-all-trades, struggle with what exactly is a certification and what does it mean. I think the more we can do to make that concrete to them, the more we can do to say, these are the skills you're asking for, and these are the skills this document proves that somebody has, I think the easier it will be for them to start to see that crosswalk. In a different role that I have, I'm assisting with the rollout of the National Career Readiness Certification, and that is one of the things we're finding as people from the WorkSource Centers are talking to employers. At first, they'll say, well, I don't really need a certification, but when that person says, well, remember when you asked me a few weeks ago, how will I know that that high school diploma means this kind of math, or how will I know that that degree means this kind of reading, you can look at the back of the certificate, and it'll tell you whether it meets your needs. And so I think the more we can do to demystify what a certification is, and to put it into plain English and not get caught up in our own language around articulation and all that, I think the easier it becomes. At least that's my opinion, and what we're starting to see, at least with the National Career Readiness Certificate. Career Pathways is very much what you described in terms of trying to find that right point where someone's got exactly what skills match with that next job title. And so I think that's also been helping to demystify that relationship. But I think, as with many things, we sometimes speak different languages and don't even realize it until we're sitting across the table. So I think that's one of the things we need to get better at.
So I'm curious. I know we could ask Karen. I'm not sure. Is there a career pathways for jack of all trades, or is that something we should pursue? Platinum CRC.
However, Rep. Huffman, you did bring up the CESP grant, the State Energy Sector Partnership Grant, and one of the pieces of that is some certification of basic green job skills in a one-year program that could then articulate to more specified college degrees and certificates. And so that is a little bit of the jack-of-all-trades approach in the first year of a program. It's similar to a manufacturing certificate that's been developed across the community colleges where it counts for every college to be able to use that core. It will be like that, where every college who accepts it will be able to use that core as part of the pathway then into other green occupational certificates.
And I see Kate is furiously typing back there, taking notes back to Commissioner Avakian, suggesting maybe an apprenticeship jack of all trades program. So I think we could be onto something here.
You just might. Yeah.
I don't know. Anything else?
I think they already got one going, it sounds like.
Well, since career technical education is near and dear to our hearts, we hate to take too much more time out of that presentation. So do you have any further questions for me, sir?
I don't see any. Agnes, right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chair Huffman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity.
Paul Joyner, Ed Armstrong, Paul, of course, is from Boley, Ed Armstrong, Tillamook Bay Community College, and I'm just going to say Tim from Northwest College of Construction, and I'll let Tim fill in the last name.
Mosterdijk.
Welcome, and I'm going to let you guys decide, Paul, if you're going to kick it off, and each of you, respectively, when you're ready to speak, be sure and introduce yourself for the record. Welcome.
Thank you. Vice Chair Huff, committee members, for the record, my name is Paul Joyner, staff with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm going to be brief this afternoon. I know we're a little behind schedule, but I do have a video that I would like to show you. It's about 6 or 7 minutes long, and I'd just like to throw a few opinions out there about career and technical education. I work with the career and technical education systems within the around the state. From a different level, though. I come in from Boley's standpoint versus the education, so I think I get a little different perspective on what goes on in current technical education. And there's some great things happening there. There really are some wonderful programs out there. And in my opinion and through my observations, those great programs all really are doing similar things, even though they're training completely different areas. They're all doing the same things, and that is collaboration with industry, with other partners around their regions, and developing programs that fit the needs of their communities. And those are the ones that are successful, and those are the ones that the students are really excited about. Another thing that I think a lot of those successful CTE programs are doing, and I'm not implying there's a lot of programs that are not successful. I think they all do good things. But there are some really superior programs, in my opinion, out there. They're doing a lot of front-end work with their students, and meaning they're making the students...
Restoration and native seed collection.
And that. and they're doing a lot of work prior to bringing the kids into the programs. They're making them earn the right to be there. So they take an ownership in those programs, and I think that's a really critical piece that students are doing. So what I'm going to show you here briefly is a program with Tillamook High School, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, Boley, and Lane County Public Works. That program is Trade Skills Fundamentals, which is a 4-credit Lane Community College class that we have articulated into Thurston High School, and this year will be the third year of that class being presented within the high school setting at Thurston.
And Paul, if I might interrupt, you had mentioned the length of the video, and Chair Witt was out, and I don't know that he heard us tee this up, so I'm going to turn it back to him and maybe give you some guidance on when we're looking to adjourn or how much time you have for your total presentation.
Okay. I will be to the video in 30 seconds.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Sounds
good. Okay. So, again, the partnership with the community college, the 4-credit class, the students in the class, a very diverse group of students. I found that out this year when we talked to them. We had all the little cliques within high school, which are many, I'm learning. We had kids from all sectors in that, and they became this kind of a herd of their own, and it was really fun to see and how they all worked together. And that's from their voices, not mine. So I'll show this to you really quick. Answer questions if you have any, and then I will be done with my piece. Okay.
28 seconds.
Was that good?
28.
In the summer of 2010, 19 students from Thurston High School's Trade Skills Fundamentals class in Springfield, Oregon, were hired to work full-time on wetland mitigation, riparian restoration, and native seed collection on 2 sites in Lane County. The students and supervisors together installed more than 145,000 plants on 265 acres of county land. In working directly in the field with professionals, the students learned about wetland science and regulation, field equipment used for environmental resource management, native and invasive plants, threatened and endangered species of the Willamette Valley, ethnobotany principles, and skills that can be applied to future green jobs and sustainability practices.
I'm Paul Joyner. I'm with the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm the Apprenticeship Preparation Manager for the state. This is phase 2 of this project with Thurston High School. It actually started 2 years ago with Trade Skills Fundamentals, a Lane Community College four-credit class that we've integrated into Thurston High School. This year we added this component to it, the work component, with grants from the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. So this is a summer work project.
This project was started about a year ago by another group of students, and then these kids are continuing on with the project. We are out here at the Short Mountain Landfill collecting seeds that will be eventually planted over on the Quamish Prairie. And they're all native plants that everything on the Quamish Prairie will be native. So everything we're collecting is a native species from Oregon.
Vegetated green infrastructure is a fairly simple solution to pollutant removal. It provides an education component to students and to engineers who are developing these systems. It's relatively comparable in cost to using mechanical stormwater pollutant removal, which is basically a manhole with some sort of removable
maybe it's going to be shorter than you think.
Filter.
Maybe longer than we think.
Yeah, that's true.
Soil water separator.
The amount of road water runoff off these.
Well.
And the.
Do you have any idea?
Yeah.
Is it on DVD?
Yes.
There may be some dust on it or something.
Nutrients in the oils.
I've had problems like that with my grandchildren handling DVDs.
Things like that to come off the road.
You know, and you end up with gum and, you know, sticky
stuff.
I'd love
to blame somebody else, but it's brand new.
It's brand new. That's
not good. Yeah.
Pardon me.
Is anyone certified?
Programs,
anybody certified out here?
I just want to call to everyone's attention the technical skills of our committee administrator.
Or like
therapist. She's the only one. Skills. There you go.
Maybe you should wait until she's done before you point those out.
We can just close and give you a brief little overview of what was going on. I'd love for you to see what the kids' comments and that pieces, but in a nutshell, the kids learned an awful lot. We used a Trade Skills Fundamentals platform. We built this sustainability training program on top of the traditional construction curriculum. But it fit really well together. It dovetailed nicely together. So the students in the class, they got presentations from apprenticeship programs, and they learned the fundamentals of what an apprenticeship is and how to get involved with an apprenticeship. But they also got to go out and do some work in the sustainability fields, and they really saw the path from both sides. They can go either way, and quite a few of the kids are very interested in traditional apprenticeship programs that still worked on these programs. It's just another way to get kids out there and involved and excited. And the one thing I will say, tooting our horn a little bit, is about half of the students in that class all stated that it was the best class they had ever had in school. So something's working there. So with that, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
We drew straws.
You drew straws. Okay, so Tim, you're next. Is that it? Okay.
I'm Tim Mosterdyke. I'm the Director of Education with the Northwest College of Construction, and I am following up on, I think you've already been presented earlier around September with a report on this collaborative task force, CTE collaboration task force. I was just made aware of this presentation about a week ago, so forgive me, I've prepared some notes. So I'm providing a follow-up on behalf of the 2010 CTE Task Force report submitted September 22nd, 2010 for your consideration. And I think that you guys all, I apologize for not making copies for you today. Yeah, we can make them available. It's an honor to have a few minutes of your time to overview the findings of this report and pull out some of its specific recommendations for further consideration. These recommendations have been designed toward promoting high school CTE programs during these economically challenging times in keeping with the mission of the task force to, quote, increase collaborative efforts and use partnerships for the purpose of better sharing facilities and resources and developing a high-skill, high-wage, sustainable workforce. My role on the task force was to represent private career schools. The recommendation for my appointment to the task force came from the Oregon Department of Education's Private Career School Advisory Committee, where I represented the Northwest College of Construction. At NWBCC, we see high school CTE programs as a critical piece of our pipeline for future tradespeople, and thus viewed my time on the task force and its mission as congruent with the mission of the college as well. In the interest of time, I did outline some of the collaborations we have with high schools. We run an on-site welding program with Park Rose High School. We do a variety of other things. NWCC operates 10 different registered apprenticeship programs, as well as construction management, safety, and on-site high school construction programs, which we are working to expand to other schools. We're presently working with the Multnomah Education School District to offer a construction survey program. It's scheduled to start this spring, and that'll draw from three local alternative high schools. The fact is 50% of high school graduates will not attend college. And while we currently gauge high school success by the number of graduates we send to college, this is actually a false measure. In this regard, success should be measured by the number of students that actually graduate from college. Taking it a step further, only 50% of those entering college will actually graduate. Therefore, if my numbers are correct and college graduation is subsequently viewed as the measure of success, only 25% of a given high school student body will actually graduate from college. In his book, Real Education, Charles Murray, best-selling author of The Bell Curve, contends, for practical purposes, about two-thirds of high school students are work-bound. We should be devoting about two-thirds of our attention to the resources, to their needs. So I ask, are the remaining 75% of high school students not destined for college graduation, given viable alternatives for careers outside the four-year college track? And then in our report here, we did pull some statistics from ODE's website. And the fact is, the kids that are engaged in CTE programs, their graduation rate is actually about 97%. So that was pretty significant. The five suggestions that we have in this report are the investment in CTE programs of study, that Oregon must adopt a long-term commitment to CTE programs of study in schools around the state and plan to invest in those programs, as well as partner with local business and industry for advice and support. Regional centers of excellence. Oregon must adopt a long-term commitment to create CTE regional centers of excellence, such as Sabin-Schellenberg, the ACE Academy, and other models of innovation. Thirdly, CTE learning continuum. Oregon must adopt a long-term commitment to articulated accelerated learning options, such as dual credit, expanded options, college now. Fourth, extended CTE learning opportunities with multiple partners. Oregon must adopt a long-term commitment to wraparound programs such as industry mentorships, internships, summer camps, and after-school programs. And finally, an awareness of CTE as a viable, successful education strategy. Oregon must support the creation of public-private partnerships to raise awareness of career and technical education among students, parents, teachers, counselors, policymakers, and general public. So, with that, I just wanted to just see if you guys had any questions. Just bring this back to your attention that this report was done.
What we could do is perhaps ask questions or provide comments when the panel's completed. Ed, were you going to have something to share here?
Thank you, Representative Witt and members of the committee. I'm Ed Armstrong. I'm actually a retired school administrator, but I tried to retire at the end of October, and the college asked me to come back, and I had to chuckle when you were talking about jack of all trades, because my name on my door is Ed Armstrong, jack of all trades. So if there is a certificate, I probably should go back to school and get that. In difficult funding times, and certainly from a K-12 standpoint, it's hard to talk about, or for some people, hard to talk about innovation. But I always take the words of Winston Churchill to heart that, well, we've run out of money, it's time to get creative. And so our community has an advantage in that we're small, and yet we're large enough with some great workforce partners and state partners such as Boley to innovate and look at some ways that we can better our community as a whole, not just as an educational system, but how do we as a community educate our young people to go into the workforce of the future, and how do we engage the existing workforce in order for them to stay in our community. We're small, as I always tell people. We have about 26,000 people in Tillamook County. We're outnumbered 2-1 by the Holsteins. But we have some opportunities that we took advantage of about 4 years ago. And the opportunity was a lunch with the human relations person from Stimson Lumber, who is one of our manufacturing firms. And he actually asked me and the superintendent to go to lunch with him. And here was his dilemma. They were spending about $140,000 a year to try and recruit skilled laborers to their mill. And the idea that his CEO had seen on the East Coast, instead of investing that $140,000 elsewhere, trying to find a skilled worker pool, and by the way, that $140,000, the net results for them was zip. They didn't get anybody because they were competing at that time with other manufacturing firms across the U.S. So what our industries have started to do is actually look at their recruiting funds, and actually we're building what I would call building our own workforce at a local basis by investing that same resource. So I just want to give it in a sense of a rural context of what we've been working on the last 4 years. We've actually, unbeknownst to us, we've been working on the white paper and the program that you've been looking at. And it's not education saying, hey, we've got, you know, our hand out that we need the money to do these good works. But we've really looked at this through a consortium of Stimson Lumber, Hampton Affiliates, who is another large lumber concern, the Tillamook Creamery, and Boley. I always consider Paul here one of our partners. And I'll just give you a quick kind of snapshot of some of the progress that we've made. 3 years ago, Tillamook Bay Community College passed a significant construction bond to build a brand new college. Their old college was located in a mortuary. It had been a mortuary, and that's where they'd been for 20-some years. So the community said, let's invest in our infrastructure, make a new community college. But the college wisely said, instead of investing because there's an existing facility at our local high school that's old and needs some renovation, they took part of that bond money and reinvigorated our career technical center. And the idea is it's joint learning space. So rather than spending for the new college having that additional CTE space, we partnered with the college, and they put about $500,000 of the bond into that space. Knowing that our workforce partners were extremely interested in helping us out, and in fact, I'll share with you, tomorrow, Hampton, along with our consortium, is presenting a model that I'm very, very proud of. Not only is it about money and a long-term commitment, but it's a model that I've waited for a long time in education. Because what has happened in education classically is we hire teachers that have been trained at some point in how to deliver educational processes, and they do a good job. But the disconnect is when they're doing a career technical program or a training program, they don't always have the life experience or the current experience that industry has. So this is almost science fiction, folks, what I'm going to describe here. What industry is going to do is they're going to support a part-time, we're going to kick in as a school district, even in our downsize mold, model, we're going to kick in a half a FTE. They're going to support a half a FTE for a science, math, career technical teacher. And industry is also building a leadership career path model that if you want to be a supervisor at their facility, one of the ways you get there is by teaming up with that CTE teacher on a short, what we would call a sabbatical from your business, paid for by business, and they will co-teach the math, science, career technical education program. And we're focusing on industrial maintenance and electrical systems. So we're going to teach hydraulics, pneumatics, all of those things that our local industries need. And I have no doubt that this model will be funded based on the feedback that the presentation team is giving. The nice thing about it, as a grant writer from my past, is that normally I would do the presentation. Here I have industry partners presenting to their senior staff members at corporate office to do this model. So I'm just giving you snapshots of where we're going, but I would really encourage you to visit the center and get an idea to carry that message about how can a small place like Tillamook with local resources and state help. I would say we need to support from the state, but I guess I would say the advocate here is that there's got to be skin in the game from all of us, not just another check from the state, because I think those days are come somewhat over. So I kind of got up on a little bit of a soapbox, but partnerships have to look, I believe, the way or one of the ways that we've done it in Tillamook. And I'll share one story that just shocked me that I learned 6 months ago, and this is an ice cream story, so it's a good close. As you know, we're the home of the world-famous Tillamook cheese. And each of those workers that are in those processes, those advanced processes, instead of being trained in refrigeration in the state of Oregon, those workers are being sent back to Kansas City because that's where they have to go in order to get that type and level of training. That is not okay. Oregon can do better than that. We have creative people, and I think these kind of bills and sponsorships where the state can step in and say, we can do better than that and build the jobs of the future. So I appreciate your time, the committee's time, and I think all of us would take questions at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for our panel members? Yes, Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say hi to Tim. You know, we were on the task force together, and Tim was really a great resource on the task force. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, in looking at the recommendations of the task force and looking at potential areas of partnership, you know, he mentioned the ACE Academy as one model, right, where different districts are coming together and partnering for a set curriculum. But the other that he kind of, you know, quickly mentioned was that the services performed by the Northwest College of Construction, which is, you know, also has been a very successful model, I think. Once Park Rose School District realized that they really could no longer afford a full-blown welding program at the high school, you know, they look to the college to do a direct relationship with them in order to do those programs. And that, you know, I think that's a very viable model. And you know, as was said, we really have to be creative about these partnerships. There are so many models out there, and one of the challenges that we face is, you know, we've heard from people who say, you know, we need the model. But there is no one model that's the correct one. There are going to be a lot of models depending on the situation of the particular school district, the high school, and the industry in the area. So, I don't know, this may be, it may be related to the jack-of-all-trades degree, but I think that, you know, flexibility and creativity really need to be not only there, but valued and promoted and celebrated, actually, in the case of the students.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, I'm just wondering from your individual perspectives what you would see as some key items that the legislature could help promote or entertain that would help facilitate this kind of education. What would be the top one, two, three, however many items that you might recommend to us at this point?
Can I take this one? The bill, that the legislative concept that has been put together, and I believe that would be yours, Representative Witt, that would be wonderful. I think that kind of concept, I personally am a fan of the Skills Center concept around the state for a couple of reasons. One, well, let me step back. If we had if I had a wand, it could do anything and money wasn't an issue. We could fully integrate current technical education into all of our school systems, fully fund them, and do a wonderful thing. That would be the cherry on the top. But realistically, we know that's probably not going to happen for some time. So the skill centers work really well, in my opinion, just as you were saying, Representative Denbrough, because they're regional, and so they can cater to the region's industry and that region's specific needs, because this is Oregon, and we are Portland and LaGrande are considerably different in their needs. Doesn't mean one is better than the other. So these kind of concepts can work really well, and so that's my hope. Is that we can get some movement and work something like that, because the numbers show that this works. You know, these kind of things work. One more little quick story, and I know what time. The Kennedy Alternative School of Sustainability in Cottage Grove in 2008 was taken over by a new administration. At that time, they had attendance numbers as low as 23%, significant dropout rates, and drug use in the school. He has come into that system and completely brought in a hands-on skill-based learning approach, amongst many other great things, to where now their attendance levels are 90%, and the graduation numbers are completely climbing in coordination with the attendance numbers. It works. These kind of things work. That's a small alternative school. They have a lot more flexibility to do these kind of fun things, but we need to have that for all of our kids. We need to have that ability to do that with all the kids.
Very good.
If I may.
Mm-hmm. Please.
As I illustrated my notes here, I put little dollar signs next to those five
Tim,
bullet
would you
points.
Just, I'm sorry, would you please just, so that the record knows where the break was and who's speaking,
yes,
if you
sir.
Would reintroduce yourself.
Tim Mosterdijk, Northwest College of Construction.
Thank you,
representing private career schools. I put dollar signs next to these suggested bullet points. I thought in our economic times that would be prudent. So I'm going to give you the one with $2 signs next to it, not three or one. The very last one was an awareness of career and technical education as a viable, successful educational strategy. And if you'll indulge me, Oregon must support the creation of public-private partnerships to raise awareness of career and technical education among students, parents, teachers, counselors, policymakers, and the general public. These partnerships will communicate the way that CTE leads to success both in school and at work, and demonstrates the positive return on the investment in CTE. An illustration is I'm currently a grad student at PSU. I had a book on the table, had a high school counselor sitting there doing some PDUs, asked me what I did, and she was not aware of apprenticeship at all. I was shocked. So just an awareness and maybe whatever we can do to bring that awareness out there.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlick, and then I'll give you a chance here in just a second.
Thank you. I was reacting to the throwaway line that you just said, that if we had all the money we needed, we'd have a CTE program in every high school. I wonder if you explore that a bit. Are you sure it's true? I mean, we started destroying industrial arts, as it was called, years ago. I mean, it was sort of the first thing thrown off the boat. And I'm not sure that it was about money. I mean, it was always about money, but how do we cut the budget? Psh, mm-hmm. The shop teacher's gone. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's true? If we just did have an infusion of money, then CTE would show up back in the high schools? Or do you think it's more related to the culture of the schools and a variety of other things?
Representative Witt, Representative Greenlick. Well, no, I don't think that's true. If we just had the money that Voc Ed and Career and Technical Education would come back into the system, it would have to be dedicated towards that specifically. But I think that we could still do that, and I think we should do that, because all kids are going to benefit from that, regardless of where they plan to go in life. If their plan is to be an MD and follow that 8-year path, those kinds of hands-on programs are greatly benefit them in that path also. So, no, it's not all about money. Absolutely, it's not all about money.
A lot of us are desperate for that to happen. And there are then people saying he may be desperate to see music in the school, which I also think is important, and art and a variety of things. But I just don't know. Portland Public School System has just managed to destroy Benson, which was a fine technical school for the longest time. I mean, I don't know how to get them to listen to the fact that CTE is urgent. And I'm very frustrated, so you all can help me with that. I think we all are. I suspect this is something this subcommittee is very interested.
We are. Ed, you look like you're chomping at the bit.
Ed Armstrong, Jack of all trades. Maybe a short answer or a strategy that I used, and I'm not suggesting this strategy for everything, but with our teachers, as an administrator, I had some pull, if you would. I guess, at least they said I did on the label. But I brought in purposely, and this goes back to the marketing piece and raising the awareness, I brought in some of our youth apprentices that we had gone through the process with Bowley. And after a year, here's a young person that's 19, 20 years old that is a third through their college work and working at the manufacturing plant at the mill. And when he stated the salary to the staff at the high school that he was currently making, they all said, can we...
Anything more than anything.
And so what we've done is I think there's those subtle pieces that don't cost anything, that our own kids can be the best voice to our teachers. That doesn't cost any. It didn't cost me any money to bring that young people in to talk about this. But the connection, and really is about relationships. The relationship that we've developed with a local industry, it's not just about a committee. It's about their very much involved as we are in their processes. Because any good work, philosophically, that you want to change, it has to be owned by the entire community. And we have to own this as a state. I guess what I'm saying is if we can elevate that to a statewide conversation, it's critical. Our success as Oregon or as the U.S. is going to be based on the educational system we provide for the future workforce. And the other conversation I've always had with the teachers, if this company relocates, they take 350 family wage jobs out, how many, just be selfish here for a second, staff, how many of those students are going to move out and how many of you are still going to have jobs? It is connected. And so, I mean, I can force those. I mean, those are the kind of conversations I think we need to start training all of our administrators to have. But, you know, extra money is great if it's deployed in new models. And I would say if you keep funding what you've done, education is insatiable as far as money. I would say that because it is. I mean, you never have enough money to get to the level that we have. I wish we did. I wish we had this huge pot. But we don't. So how do we build conversations that really better the community and better the state of Oregon? And that's, I think that's the message that you could use with a bill like this. This is not about education, all about education. This is about the future of Oregon. Mm-hmm. This truly is about the future of Oregon. And so just instituting new programs without some good philosophy behind it, without that public relations piece, is not going to be enough because it'll soon be forgotten without that more critical marketing message.
Just a brief follow-up.
Please.
And then I'll shut up. I'm impressed that we're hearing from a community college, and I mean, in a sense, do we just give up on the high schools and try and link the community colleges into the high schools for vocational training?
No, that's really not what I'm saying. It's about a partnership.
Oh, no, I knew
right.
You weren't saying
right,
that.
Right,
no,
right. Sorry.
You're asking the question. Yeah, I'm asking the question. I mean, we see that much more responsiveness from the community colleges that we hear from. So, I mean, maybe rather than trying to get those industrial art teachers who are gone, they're not here anymore, back into the high schools to push the community college program into the high school so the high school students can take advantage of shop classes, if you will, in the community colleges as a part of their high school training.
I'm going to be sensitive to time, but again, our philosophy, I'm going to talk about it at Tillamook, is we start at kindergarten on career technical education. So we're having students out in service projects, in amazing restoration projects, so at every grade level, even though they don't know it, they're getting exposed to careers, sometimes subtly, sometimes in your face. And so high school has a role, as does a community college, as does the workforce. And the jack of all trades that I've had the grace to have in my career, I've been a business owner, I've been a high school teacher, administrator, and now I'm wearing a name tag that says community college. This is a two-month-old role for me. But it all is about, for me, it always is about the community. How do you make this community better? And it's not one organization or agency or business that's going to do that. We got to move forward. And I see that the same way that you could leverage what you're doing here as a move forward through a good marketing plan. I think that's what Tim, but you have to market this as an opportunity, not just money deployed into some old structures. Is that, I mean, I don't want to speak for you there, Tim.
Tim Osterdijk, Northwest College Construction. It's marketing, but it's marketing amongst the status quo folks that are not aware of alternative instruction. If I may, quick, I think one of the issues I brought out on this 97% graduation rate for CTE students. To me, there might be a somewhat inexpensive compromise. I think a big part of it is are the teaching methods within career and tech ed classes. It's all hands-on. It's engaging. We have academic instructors, math instructors, English instructors, these folks that they could utilize problem-based learning theory. They could engage these kids, in my opinion, better. I've made the statement that I could, in my shop class, teach every subject in that high school, from biology to math to science.
My son-in-law is an ex-industrial art teacher who's in the Portland Public School System on a grant for the last 10 years, teaching systems theory and building systems theory curriculum in the middle school as a way of getting people to think about how these things operate on a hands-on way. We've got so damn much to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
It's
a wonderful discussion. In fact, you've stimulated several of our other members here. I have up next Representative Esquivel, and then have Representatives Holby on deck and Dembro in the hole. So, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. We have, in Southern Oregon, we have a rogue community college that has a facility on Table Rock campus that is quite capable of handling any high school in the area, but the high schools are reluctant, and I'm going to tell you why. It's because it's money. Because once those students go to the community colleges will collect for a half of a day, and they aren't willing to do that, so they're going to sacrifice our kids, 82% of them, sacrifice them because of their money. And that's the most unfortunate, egregious thing we can do as educators. The other thing that we need to do in these schools is stop berating the blue-collar worker. Just because you go to college, and I always look at it like this, if you're an idiot and you go to college, you become an educated idiot. It doesn't make you any more intelligent. It makes you better educated. And unfortunately, what we're doing in our high schools, I do know for a fact in Southern Oregon, that we do berate the blue-collar worker. And I'll tell you what, give me a plumber any day.
Especially when you have a clogged drain.
That's right.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on Representative Greenlee's question about whether, if we had the money, would that solve the problem, or is it a cultural thing? And, you know, I always, having worked in this area for a while, always thought it was the money, essentially. And today I think we'll be hard-pressed to do anything in career technical because of the fiscal situation we find ourselves in. And I'm not going to berate our K-12 system. You know, they're in a crunch too. We're cutting $30 million out of my school district. That's a lot of money, and we're talking about not meeting federal mandates for education. So a lot of these mandates are driving some of the fiscal, I guess, decisions that school districts are making as well. But to answer Representative Greenlee's question, I think it is money, but it is also culture. And I remind this committee that we passed a bill that was one of the bills we worked very hard on last session, and I'm still troubled by it because we set aside about $6 million through some federal stimulus dollars that went to community college and workforce development to fund specifically the ACE Academy and models like that to move down that pathway of a new and innovative type of program to get career technical education, at least some a semblance of it, somewhere in the state. And that money never made it to where this committee intended it to go, unfortunately. And I don't... I can't hold the community college and workforce development department responsible for it. I don't know if I can hold the governor's office responsible for it or ways and means responsible for it. All I know is it didn't happen, and I really never got a clear explanation of why our policy didn't get implemented. Maybe the chair could answer that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's his fault.
Can we have a vote on this?
No. But I guess my point would be that I think it is culture because, we went through that whole system. We had some dollars available to do exactly what we're talking about today again, and it didn't make it through the cultural decisions that were made down the line to prioritize that policy. It got chopped somewhere.
And Representative Holby, I think we've seen, we've had a lesson in the physics that bodies at rest sometimes stay there. And it's unfortunate.
It's Newton's fault.
I try to defy physics every time.
I understand, and never let them stop you from trying to, Representative Holby. So, with, Representative Dembro.
Thank you, and I appreciate that lesson in applied learning. I think, we have to get something out of these hearings other than that. But I agree with both of those points, that there is a fiscal element to it. And I think that as hard as it is, we do need to keep working on some programmatic funding for CTE, you know, dedicated funding. And ideally, I think, along the lines of what Ed was proposing, that is, that would promote good behavior or stimulate good behavior, not just take a pot of money and throw it out so that it becomes $10 for each school district, but things that are really intelligent and targeted. The question was why community colleges seem more interested in this than the school districts. Part of it is just simply because of the mission that we have set community colleges. I mean, one of their primary missions is professional technical education. And there is an expectation that, a certain percentage, a fourth, a third, somewhere along those lines, of their courses are going to be professional technical courses. We have nothing like that at all in the K-12 system. And it really is something I think that we need to keep talking about and thinking about. The opportunity for partnerships are so rife. Tim was pointing to the role that the need for mainstream teachers to understand the positive, the benefits of applied learning. The unions, I know, in the Portland area have come together and have expressed interest in running workshops, summer programs, workshops. And Tim himself is, his school is interested in that, for, math teachers, for applied learning projects as a way of, alternative ways of teaching these concepts. There are some kids who the traditional, book learning, it doesn't work. And so what do? We make them take if they fail a class, we make them repeat the class and then take another class just like it, as opposed to maybe putting them through a summer program, which would be project-based. All of Oregon's high school students are going to need to get to Algebra 1 in ninth grade as we roll into our new standards. What do we do with those kids in eighth grade who are not ready to be there? Putting them through a summer program, which would expose them to career learning and maybe apprenticeship programs down the line, that would teach them the skills that would make them ready to do Algebra 1, and that would also just make them part of a team, a cohort, which in a lot of cases, that's really what these kids need. That is such a valuable kind of route for us to take. To do that, it's not going to be able to be done by the school districts alone, though. It's going to take partnerships with, business and industry willing to donate dollars and time and mentors, et cetera. It's those wraparound things that I think are really the key to all this. And so it's not just simply a question of, bring shop back to the schools. It's a much bigger agenda than that.
It's an approach. It's a systems approach. Well,
one final thing, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
Thank you. I just, I haven't discussed this with you this session, but I have discussed it with Representative Dembro, and have delivered a copy of a to Boley under the Apprenticeship Division on a legislative concept I have that will generate revenue specifically for
in this particular case, specifically for models like the ACE Academy, the construction-related training, and it's a revenue resource that doesn't come from the general fund and doesn't involve raising taxes. So I'm hopeful that the innovative approach to this resource funding will make it through this building this session in resource-starved times. I'm not positive whether I can avoid total fiscal impacts, but it would be pretty small, I think. But I'm really excited about identifying a funding stream, and I do mean stream, that isn't just a one-time, but that could expand models like the ACE Academy and other, you know, partnerships like that, especially to high school students. So I'm hoping at some point to have that discussion next session.
We will look forward to that, Representative Holvey. Tim, you had a...
If you don't mind,
please.
Just a quick follow-up on the ACE Academy. They're just right down the block from us, and we're very aware of their programs, and I was just going to tell you real quickly, I was involved on their steering committee and their curriculum committee in its inception, and as you know, we have our apprenticeship programs are open shop programs, and on our committee meetings, there was representatives from union electricians, sheet metal, et cetera. We had four district superintendents at the table establishing that program. And I left that room thinking, wow, what just happened here? This, it was very it was enjoyable. And I think there's a model there that it has kinks. It has, I think we need school districts to help encourage it, work around it, and incorporate it. But it's yeah, it's a good model.
Well, I want to express my appreciation to the subcommittee members as well as our panelists here today. This has been a thoroughly enjoyable discussion. I think a very good discussion. Paul and Tim, you made the case that we have to not only find a pathway, but hopefully a superhighway for those two-thirds of our students who are workforce-bound. And as Ed made the case, it is for the future of our state. With that, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. I want to thank our subcommittee members as well as our administrative staff, and a committee assistant for some very fine work that this interim subcommittee has done. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.